Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Sparkcast, Season 6, Episode 29. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hello there, kids.
We also have Jaime Lopez Jr. on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And once again, no fact check. Well, there is fact check, but we'll talk about it in context of the show because Keen has sent us a bunch of notes, but we'll save that for the actual episode itself. So, yeah. So, Jaime, you're up first.
Yes, we have wondered, pondered, and worried, perhaps, or at least I have, on this podcast of, like, what in the world is going on with season two of Star Trek Prodigy? Like, you know, it's had this long... terrible history so far, having been removed from Paramount Plus in a tax write-off culling. But apparently, it is a new home on Netflix. So the first 20 episodes of the first season, or I should say, the first episode. Let me restate that because I'm so enthused by this. The first season, the entire first season of Prodigy, will come later this year to Netflix, and sometime next year in 2024, we'll get that second season. Yeah. So even though, you know, Paramount Plus has explicitly decided to no longer be the home for all things Star Trek, you now have, you know, a service you likely have or will have around that time to watch.
I feel like we should, as part of our little endeavor here on Spotcast, have a meme that says, Paramount Plus, the exclusive home of Star Trek, for however many days it was before they canceled Star Trek Prodigy and moved it to Netflix. It's genuinely strange. I'm glad it's going over. Again, wasn't my favorite Star Trek property, but I will 100% watch the second season. Just the fact that there is this fracturing like 5 seconds after they just consolidated is very funny to me.
It's weird.
It's ridiculous.
Sure, there's like a fact check here, but it feels to me like the predecessor, CBS All Access, I don't think that ever had all of Star Trek, because I think some of the movies were still hanging around elsewhere as like they were waiting for the rights to fall off, mm-hmm. and then they could just put it exclusively on their service. And I think they'd made the transition to Paramount Plus by that point. So I think it's, you know, a very, very short period of time, to your point there, that this glittering moment, a dust in the wind moment, yeah. where it was like the one-stop shop for all things Star Trek. And now it's like, nope, I guess piracy is the only way to get all things Star Trek now.
But it's legit. Like, you could put it on a t-shirt. It's like your exclusive home for all things Star Trek for like 54 days. Like that's it. Yeah. That was it. That was the entire window when that was true.
Yeah. That's dumb. So dumb. I mean, like, yeah, ridiculous. I mean, because, like, Crave was just had Star Trek on it just up until very recently. And I think Netflix had Star Trek as well.
It did,
Until they clawed it all back, right?
Yep.
So,
but yeah.
Almost all of it.
What a gong show.
But one tablespoon, yeah.
Well, I guess it's good news. I mean, you're right, Jaime. We've been talking about how it's, been kind of hanging out there, that not only was there, like, already finished product waiting for a home, but that, they teased it. They showed us a little bit of it, you know, like it was tantalizing that it was there. I really, truly wonder if that's sort of the one and done of it, though, if they're going to do any more, or if it's just like wrap up the whole story in season two and we're out.
I don't know. But speaking of backpedaling.
Oh, yes. So we have a story this week about the Daredevil Born Again, the revamp, reborn TV show Daredevil that was supposed to be on Disney Plus. Good story that came out this week, originally reported by the Hollywood Reporter, that the two lead writers for it, Chris Ord and Matt Corman, were both quietly let go after the show was put on hiatus due to the writer's strike. Kevin Feige and the powers that be at Marvel took a look at what they had produced so far. They had already filmed a bunch of stuff, and they sort of looked at what they had since they have had time to reflect. And looked at it and were like, yeah, this isn't what we're trying to do here. And so they fired the two lead writers and they are going back to the drawing board. They are hiring all new writers and all new directors. They do think that they can incorporate some of the material they've already shot in a logical way, although I'm a little nervous about that because that always ends up really weird when you're like, you know, going back and adding other parts to glue things together. It's like the Frankenstein's monster of movie making and TV making. But interesting that they've taken this step, and apparently they didn't really make it a public thing. They just sort of quietly said, your services are no longer required, and it came out 3 months later. But hopefully in the end, what we're talking about is a better product. I really enjoyed the Daredevil Netflix series. Obviously, they wanted to do something carrying forward some of those characters, but not necessarily in the exact same way. We've already seen Charlie Cox in both the most recent Spider-Man movie, as well as in She-Hulk, playing both Matt Murdock and Daredevil. But not a good sign. Not really a good sign when they make these kinds of changes after filming for a while already.
Does that mean Charlie Cox is still going to come back? They're just going to rewrite?
It doesn't sound like they're recasting. Like they already had confirmed that Charlie Cox would be back. They already had confirmed that John Bernthal was going to come back as the Punisher. There's some hires that are definitely happening, although I don't think they're bringing back, I think they had said they're not bringing back Deborah Ann Woll as Karen Page, which is a bit of a drag because I really liked her too. But it's a strange development, and I'm not sure what that says about where Marvel TV is at, and I'm not sure what that says about when we're going to see this next year. But I hope it's for the better. I hope that they're trying to get things in row. I can't decide if it's admirable that they realized it wasn't working and pulled the plug, or if it's a bad sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem like, you know, a positive angle that could come out of this is if the enforced pause because of the strikes made them say, you know what, let's reevaluate what this release train has on it. You know, that's arguably a better thing than just like full steam ahead. We got to fill in, you know, September 24 or whatever it was they were shooting for.
Yeah.
If they can say, you know what, maybe we need to think about how we're really approaching this from, you know, I think one of the things that you can run into is like, oh, it's an interwoven story. It's like, yeah, but like people need to be able to like watch it and be casually sort of able to understand too.
Yeah.
Like that's the best balance where like, it's even better if you have been following every bit of media, but it shouldn't be a strict requirement either. And yeah. I know there were, I don't know that it's true in any way here, but it was really funny, seeing like, you know, oh, he doesn't take on the Daredevil costume until the fourth episode. Yeah. It's like, well, that's dumb. Yeah. That's really dumb. because people are like, I thought this was a superhero thing. Why is it like 100% of the time? Are you sure it's not a legal drama? Is it a legal drama? What am I watching here?
Yeah. You're right, Jaime. And it's funny because when you mentioned that, it reminded me that for the first season of the Netflix series, now Netflix's delivery model is very different in that they dropped all the episodes at once, but we don't see Matt Murdock in the Daredevil costume per se until the end of the first season of the Netflix series, but he is still a masked vigilante from the very beginning, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense because it's like, you know, Daredevil Begins. It's like, oh, how did he become? Okay. And since you're right, since you don't have to wait 4 weeks to see, or 8 weeks or whatever it was, you can just trust that the little preview trailer, like, yeah, this dude gets into the costume. It's not just a legal drama. Like, you can see how that can work. Whereas now it's like, this dude is established. Like, you know, if you're going to have him not in costume, it's like, it better be because he's in somebody else's season, not in costume.
Yeah.
There, but not in costume. And it's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to put this costume back on. Cool. In my own series. Right. Like, it's kind of strange because the series is from somewhere else, but it is available on Disney Plus. So people really wanted to go watch the back catalog. They could. So I could see where somebody is like, you know what? we need some establishing shots where, like, this dude needs to have the costume on in the first episode, even if it's like, you know,
a flashback. From there. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, put him here talking to Tig Notaro, explaining where we're going to go. And then we spend the next three episodes getting there.
Yeah. I guess the best case scenario out of this is Rogue One, right? So there were the stories that Rogue One production was a, you know, they weren't happy with it. They were screening it. They went back and did some reshoots. In the end, I think we agree that Rogue One is a pretty good movie, but there are lots of these sort of Hollywood Reporter type stories that, you know, that was a troubled production. They had to go do some rewriting, do some stuff on the fly to get it to where they wanted it to be. And it turned out to be a pretty solid product. So maybe this is for the best.
Yep. We'll see. Well, speaking of productions out of control, my old art teacher used to say that every great artist needs somebody behind them with a sledgehammer to hit you over the head when you're done. Ridley Scott needs one of those because he's, as you know, is in November, the Napoleon movie is coming out. It's supposed to be on Apple TV Plus, but I think it's going into the theaters first. And he teased about how long it was a while back, like 270 minutes long. And which basically means, you know, you'd need several rest stops if you went and saw it in the theaters. As it is, it's going to run 2 hours and 38 minutes, which is pretty long. But there's a special 4-hour cut that's going to be shown on Apple TV Plus. So we are going to get to see the director's cut when it comes to Apple TV Plus. Although in the theaters, you will see in IMAX, I'm sure you'll see the Napoleon condensed Reader's Digest version. I don't know what
it was. The abridged version. Yeah.
The abridged version. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because the promo shot here on this article is a picture of Napoleon crowning his, after he gets crowned emperor, he crowns his wife as empress, right? Mm. And it's based on a painting by Jacques-Louis David that's in the Louvre, and it's got to be, I think it's like 25, 30 feet wide by about, ooh, you know, I mean, the people in the painting are life size.
Wow.
Yeah. It's got, I mean, it's like two stories of my house and almost as long as my house. You know,
wow.
Like it's huge. It's giant. Yeah. So we did go and see that one in 2014 when we were there, but yeah, it's kind of, I think the spectacle of that type of painting that Jacques-Louis David did back in the day is, I think that's what Ridley Scott's going for here.
Wow.
So, yeah, Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon. So, the man you love to hate, playing the man you love to hate.
I feel like I have some complicated feelings because I do appreciate the fact that streaming frees us up to do things differently. I question the idea of having, you know, a 4 to 4 hour plus kind of movie. I'm like, well, why isn't it a miniseries then?
Exactly right, Jaime. Exactly right.
If you want to compare, like, well, it's epic. It's like, let me tell you some epics here, because I looked. It's like Spartacus, 3 hour 17. Yeah. 10 Commandments, 3 hour 40, which, you know, with TV commercials and stuff, it's like 4.5 hours, I think, on like broadcast television, you know, during various religious holiday time periods. And then Lawrence of Arabia, 3 hours and 42 minutes. These are, you know, well-understood epics that really push the boundary. Even they don't cross the 4 hour mark. So I feel like if it had to be a movie, you know, couldn't they have split this up a little differently? Like, I get it's tough. Like, you can really go deep into, if you're covering from like beginning to end Napoleon, and 4.5 hours doesn't seem like enough, where you could make a longer series if you wanted to. But if you're going to have it be a movie, I feel like maybe it really should have been like two movies, you know? It's like, Avengers Infinity War and Endgame were like, guess what? Napoleon wins surprisingly at the end of the first one, if you don't know your history. Yeah. And then guess what? He loses right there where I'm sure there's like
Waterloo.
Yeah, exactly. They said right here, we're going to build a university right in this spot. This is going to be the quad where this dude like lay down and defeat, you know? I'm sure that's not how it really happened, but like, you know, dramatization, right? You show what happens there. And you just have it as two movies. It can be 2.5 hours, 3 hours, like, it's really just an odd choice. It's kind of a no man's land kind of choice. And I might wait to see what people say, because I'm almost inclined to just watch the longer version. But if people say, no, man, it could have trimmed off like 45 minutes, then I will watch the shorter version. So I probably won't watch it immediately. I'll see what other people do and how they think about it.
Well, then you get the stuff like the Harry Potter movies that were split in half. And then the last one that got split in half, which was kind of annoying, is the Mission Impossible one that just came out, right? It's, John, just go take a seat in the corner for a minute. But I swear, I thought it could have ended like five times. And then I went, oh, wait a minute, they haven't done the big stunt yet, right? The big one that he, you know, risked his life for and all that stuff, right? But that was a complete package of a movie, and yet they don't resolve the plot at the end of the movie. So you have to go back and, you know, wait 9 months for the next go around to see the rest of it, right? It's coming to streaming. It's coming to pay home premiere or whatever, home rental this weekend, right? And so in a few months it'll be available for free. But so you'll probably see what I'm talking about. But because it's a long freaking movie. And yeah, and you know, leave. What was the Jack Snyder, the Snyder cut of?
Oh, Justice League. Zack Snyder. Yeah.
I mean, I consumed that in three sittings. I mean, I watched the first part of it and thought, I really need to go have lunch and eat dinner and, you know, do some work, take the dog for a walk. And then I came back and watched a little bit more. And then you know, the supper bell rang, and I thought, okay, well, so yeah, I didn't watch that all at once, right? And it's painful to do that in the theater these days, right? Because, you know, you want to take a break to go to the bathroom. Like admittedly, Lawrence of Arabia, yeah, it was long, but it had a 15-minute intermission, mm-hmm. right?
So the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah, they had an intermission. Gandhi had an intermission. You can get up and, you know, take care of business, buy more popcorn, you know, get another hot dog. But yeah, it's ridiculous. So, but you're right. I mean, mm-hmm. I'd rather not have to go and see it in two sittings in a theater, if I'm going to go to a theater, which I probably will, because it's a Ridley Scott movie. But I don't know. It's like, what are they going to cut out of the, what plot line are they going to cut out of the, like the house elf story in the Napoleon movie or what? Between the 4-hour and the 3-hour version.
Yeah. Do you remember when the house elves uprose in France? That was a whole thing. Yeah.
Or when the little people from Time Bandits came.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if this is just a bit of hubris on Ridley Scott's part. And he was just like, I'm Ridley Scott.
This is probably his swan song, right? Like, it's probably, I mean,
he's quite an old person, but then, you know, there are certainly lots of people who are productive, you know, at an older age, and obviously,
yeah,
who knows? But I mean, this sounds like he was taking a big swing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an epic story. I mean, how many people have actually attached this story? Like, I think it was a miniseries if I ever saw it on TV, but I can't think of the last time I saw anything about Napoleon other than like Ian Holm playing him in Time Bandits for 20 minutes. You
know? and well.
And yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Next up, interesting news this week. So this kind of one, it both flew and didn't fly under the radar. So the New York Times actually did a piece on this, which I was impressed by, but only because they announced this at the New York Comic Con, which started yesterday and is continuing this week. So there's an announcement that there's going to be a new comic book imprint at Image Comics. So that is to say, there's a new creator-owned sort of group of people that are going to be publishing through Image Comics a new, brand new series of comics. It's going to be called Ghost Machine is the name of the imprint. The fact that this is kind of an echo of how Image itself started back in the 90s, the idea of Image Comics in the 90s was Marvel and DC, particularly Marvel, were making money hand over fist, and all the intellectual property that these artists and writers were making were owned by those companies. And a lot of the people were like, I'm brimming with ideas, I'm selling you millions of books, like, why do I not get more out of this? So a group of very talented creators broke off, formed their own company, and it's based on the idea of creators' rights. They are collectively funding the sort of publishing part of it so they can publish their own products, but they get to keep all the IP for themselves. They get to maintain all the intellectual control. And so this is really interesting because it's a group of creators moving over to create their own imprint, working with Image, but again, under their own banner. But really significant and lost in a little bit of the reporting of this is these people are now exclusive to working in this group. And it's really interesting because we're talking about comic creators like Brad Meltzer, Brad Meltzer is a New York Times bestselling thriller, you know, spy novel writer. We're talking about Geoff Johns, who has written some of the most important, impactful comics over the last 25 years. We're talking about artists like Gary Frank, Brian Hitch, Francis Manipal, who's Canadian, lives here in Toronto, Peter Tomasi, Jason Fabok, who these are people who have worked on some of the biggest books. We're talking like Batman, Superman, big comics for over the last decade plus. All of them are now exclusive to this. They're not going to be doing work for other companies. They're focused their energy on all of this. So we basically got this sort of Image Comics 2.0 of all these super high-end creators all putting all their energies into creating original content under this new imprint and pushing it out through Image Comics. This is a big deal for comics publishing. And it also pulls all that talent away from the big two.
Neat.
Yeah. So this could be really interesting. So keep, they haven't announced any titles. They haven't announced when we're going to start seeing the first books. I will, of course, keep you updated because I'm a big fan. But this will be really interesting to follow. This could be a really good development for indie publishing and could be a bit of a kick in the butt for some of those larger books.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, this one, I don't know. The thing that I am wondering is, am I jumping on some of the imagery that they're showing here because it's something new, or am I getting really tickled to pink because I'm a gentleman of a certain age and I'm like, wow, this really reminds me of like early 90s Image stuff.
Yeah.
Or Marvel stuff. So I had to look this up because I wasn't sure. I was like, I really got into this era around the time that Ghost Rider, the Danny Ketch version, was like, oh, okay, like this cool new character, Ghost Rider. Oh, it turns out there's a character from the 70s that's Ghost Rider. Like, it has that sort of feel. So my eye was and this is not a visual medium, so apologies, it's a podcast. My eyes were drawn to like this like skeleton glowing ghost hooded guy with like the Eskrima sticks.
That's Geiger. That's an existing comic that Geoff Johns and Gary Frank did under Image Comics that are moving under this imprint.
Ah, there we go. There we go. And then you throw that in there in what I'm just going to assume is a team up with like sort of Black Panther. And a red coat, for lack of a better term, like just a straight up British red coat. I'm like, this is so nuts. I kind of want to start reading these already as it is. So, I don't know.
Yeah, it does say at the end of this article that April 2024, the article we'll have in our show notes is from comicbook.com. I didn't grab the New York Times one because they have a paywall. It basically they're moving over. Some of the people have already been working with Image. They're moving all of the ones that those creators had done because they own the IP. It's exciting. I must admit, I've had a chance to talk to Francis Manipal before. He's an absolutely lovely human being. And I'll be really curious to learn a little more of this. But you're right, it does kind of have an Image 2.0 nostalgia to it too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, before you go too far, I just wanted to do some real time Napoleon fact check. Just
bring it,
folks at home. So originally done in 1927.
Oh,
miniseries. Here you go, Jaime. Miniseries done in 2002. There was another one in 2015. And there's some one where he dances called Napoleon Dynamite.
No, that is a different thing, I think.
There's one where he plays a dog. Yeah, so.
And then Napoleon the dog. Yeah, it's true. That's a different thing, too.
Dog, yeah. So it has been done in those other formats, just in case, people. There's a Jack Nicholson one listed here, too, but I don't think it's ever been seen the light of day.
Oh.
Yeah, so there have been Napoleon movies in the past.
Good one. Yeah. Yeah, and I similarly find no evidence that the site of the University of Waterloo does not appear to be the same site.
No, it's where not the he same loses.
It's nearby, adjacent, like, bedroom community driving distance away is what it seems to be.
Yeah.
I don't recall that. Well, that famous time when Napoleon tried to come over and take over Canada, right?
So. Yes. University of Waterloo here is a big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so carrying on the comics theme, some unfortunate news to share this week that the comic book writer and artist Keith Giffen died this week. Giffen was not the household name. He wasn't the, you know, the Stan Lee of it, but for a lot of readers from the 70s through to modern times, he was certainly a name you knew. Very famously, he helped co-create Rocket Raccoon, who, of course, we all know from the Marvel movies. He co-created a character called Lobo, which was extremely popular in the 90s and early aughts. And he was an artist. He was very influential in the early 80s and mid 80s, creating stories for a book called Legion of Superheroes, created what is considered probably the greatest, co-created, I should say, along with Paul Levitz, one of the seminal stories for the Legion of Superheroes. One of the works that he's best known for, and one that I will always hold closely to my heart, in the mid-1980s, when they did the whole Crisis on Infinite Earths and they rebooted all of the comic series, the old DC series, and they did a new Superman number one and a new Flash number one and a new, you know, all these characters were given a new start and a fresh coat of paint, and they started them up so that people would have this new access point, which is been done 1,000 times since, but this was the first sort of really big reboot of a major company like this. Keith, and along with J.M. DeMatteis Kevin Maguire, did the reboot of the Justice League, and their take on the Justice League was that not only was that these heroes that got together and fought crimes together, but that they were kind of a dysfunctional family, and it was based a lot on humor as well as action. And it was such a breath of fresh air. It was such a different take. It was genuinely laugh out loud funny at times. The relationships between, like, the Green Lantern didn't get along with Batman, and Martian Manhunter had an addiction to Oreo cookies. And it was just like, it was all this sort of weird quirkiness that they added into the stories that I just loved the mashup of those two things. It's been done since. It's rarely done as well. I just absolutely adore that series. It's just hits me in the sweet spot of both nostalgia as well as just I've gone back and reread it and I still laugh at the way they did it. So yeah, really sad to hear about his passing this week, but I really heartened to see so many people in the comics community sharing their story. Apparently he was I never had a chance to meet Keith Giffen, but apparently he was a proud curmudgeon. But then so many people have been sharing stories about, you know, how when you worked with him, he was incredibly collaborative and he was such a nice person and, you know, just absolutely everything that you'd want from somebody that creative. So yeah, very sad to hear about his passing, but glad that he's getting a little bit of the adulation he deserves for creating such great material over the years. I will definitely miss him. I was a big fan of his work. And Tim, you'll appreciate this. As an artist, he kind of reinvented himself midway through his career. He had a very sort of specific visual style that he used for his early work. And then mm-hmm. he focused a little more on writing. And when he came back to doing art, he radically changed his art style. Like, you, if I put them side by side, you would see in his composition, but not, you know, a lot of it looked very different. And yep. It was really interesting to see how he just, like, you may have not have even been able to recognize that it was the same person. It was really interesting that he just completely changed. And people thought, like, oh, like, did he die and somebody else is using his name? Like, it was so different. I really love both styles. So yeah, really neat.
Yeah, that actually is something that happened in 20th century art, that artists do change as they get older and they change their style, do different things. And of course, there was a whole bunch of period of everybody copying, you know, how Rolling Stones are a good example of bands that copy the trends, right?
Yep.
Oh, not uncommon.
Yeah.
Picasso had like 20 different periods of styles that he went through.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Lobo character, I'm glad you brought up that because I wasn't familiar off the top of my head with his art, but I'm definitely familiar with the Lobo character. I think it's a credit to the character's design that it can adapt to so many different things. So if you just Google search for Lobo, you can see various different styles, but yet it's like, oh yeah, I kind of recognize that. So the perhaps best emphasis on this, so the article that Jonathan has chosen here is a very much like heavy metal, the movie kind of style-ish, right? kind of that, you know, heavy metal music kind of art with a bit of grotesque and stuff in there. But you can also look and find stuff. Like, I do remember really enjoying the take on the character from the Superman, the animated series. Mm-hmm. So you heavily simplify down to, you know, like 20 lines make up the characters. I'm exaggerating, but like, you can simplify that art style down, have the characters still be recognizable, visually distinct and recognizable, but feel like they fit in with a character who's very much almost the polar opposite of the main cast character, right? So I do enjoy in general seeing Superman teamed up with people who are completely unlike him, which is why Brave and the Bold type stuff works. Maybe you put him up with a grungy version of Batman, and you have a grungy character in Lobo with Superman. Nice one there. So circling back to here, yeah, you know, rest in peace, Keith Giffen, and, you know, kudos for the Lobo character for me personally.
Yeah, it's a bit of a coincidence. There's a Lobo compendium that you can order now that's coming out next year that is sort of that whole era in one sort of giant volume. I think it's something very, very, very large number of pages in there, but it kind of captures that whole era of that character. So if you're feeling wistful, it's going to be available for your bookshelf soon.
I have one more, but it's related to the show. So I'm just going to talk about it and then we'll roll right into it. Sorry, did we do mummies? No, we
didn't. No. But mine is really brief. Yeah, it's one that you definitely should, you know, pull off to the side of the road if you're transporting your home and watch the video from the link in the show notes. Here, Disney's Imagineering folks have engineered a system to make, you know, robots that can move around and navigate the real world. But not just in a like Boston Dynamics sort of way of like, wow, it's technically impressive. Yes, they sometimes make them dance and choreographed things, but it's not, you know, necessarily charismatic. And these folks focused on the, can we make this thing move in an animated fashion the way that an animator would want them to show personality and charisma and still have it not topple over in the real world? And it's like really, really impressive work. And I will point out that folks in the comments said, you know what, this really looks like they're getting ready to put these, you know, a version of BD-8 from the Star Wars games right out there in Galaxy's Edge or something. Like if you just project how this particular design of the character, you kind of squint and it almost looks like that character, the little robot companion from, what's the Star Wars one called? Is it no. Jedi? Star Wars Jedi? What is that one I'm thinking of? With Cal Kestis?
Oh, Jedi Survivor, I think?
Yeah, there's a couple of games that are out there. He's got a little droid that looks not identical, but very much like this. And I'm like, oh yeah, they're definitely going to have these walking around the Disney parks pretty soon.
Cool.
Before we go into the Star Trek thing, this Mike McMahon just posted this on Twitter just before the show started. You can now get a triple badgy t-shirt from their swag store. Got three different badges, and that'll lead into the show, which is all about badgie. Star Trek Lower Decks, Season 4, Episode 7, A Few Badgies More. So what do you got for your pitches? Do I pick one of you?
Yeah, I'll go. Mine's very straightforward. I wrote down sort of the A plot and the B plot of Rutherford and Mariner must try to foil Badgie's plot, his evil plot. Well, Tendi and Boimler are paired up to foil the evil plot of Peanut Hamper and Agabus.
Hmm. Yeah, I took something from the show. The love conquers evil, even if you're not a meat pipe.
Yeah, I think I'll go with we don't need no stinking badgies.
We don't need more stinking badgies.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's quite the sort of quote there, because meat pipe
can be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
So,
yes.
So humans, those of you, you know, for future archaeologists, you know, aliens who come here and uncover this very show. So humans, when you really think about it, really are just a tube of meat. You may say, what? No, that's ridiculous. Like, really? So what happens? Just go grab like a chicken nugget and consume it. And then think about what happens to that chicken nugget like 4 to 8 hours later.
Tim, please use this as the excerpt for the episode next week.
Just a tube that goes all the way through everything else that you're basically like, and I am, and everybody else here is basically an earthworm, right? Just a tube of meat.
Of meat?
With some adornments. You know, we've got extra adornments. Yes, that's true. But like, yeah, like, meat pipe, it might be a reasonable thing for a machine, an AI, to consider us.
Well, isn't it? It was TNG, right? Bags of mostly water?
Also true.
Why do bags of mostly water do this?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Thanks for that, Jaime. Pew, pew, pew. The scene where Badgy is repeatedly shooting at the Cerritos and yelling boop on your nose over and over again had me in stitches.
That was a good one. It was a good pew, pew, pew. And it sort of harkens back to the Star Trek Generations movie of like they can bypass the shuttle frequencies and do extra damage. Yeah. The shield frequencies are getting bypassed.
Yep.
Was that the Borg or... The Borg did that.
No, well, I see where you went there, where like they would adapt to the shield frequency. But in this case, I'm talking about the Duras sisters.
Yeah, in Generations.
Know, they get hijacked Geordi's visor. They could see the shield frequency and just punch through the shields like they weren't there.
Yeah. And 10 minutes later, they finally realized that and put the shields up.
One Easter egg we missed a couple of weeks ago, I just noticed when I was watching back again, was that one of the people, remember the episode with the Bajorans where they were all going crazy?
Mm.
One of the people in the bar was wearing Geordi's visor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a good background catch.
And Easter eggs on this one? Binars, obviously.
Yeah.
Yes, right up front.
I didn't really see much. I'm sure there's some other stuff mixed in. I want to go back and rewatch it with some of the stuff in the AI prison and stuff like that, because I'm sure there's more stuff in there. Although I really enjoyed some of the names that they were dropping, the Lord Tyrannicus and Tyrannicilicus. And, you know, they're having a lot of fun with that. But yeah, really, I like that they have been doing this sort of recurring motif at the beginning of these episodes as they build this sort of thing around the mystery ship that that appears and up until now was appearing to destroy all these ships. And the fact that they have all this banter between the crew and they're telling jokes and stuff like that. And we see the same thing play out, but it's Binar. So they're all talking in Binar, which sounds like, you know, peeps and pops.
Chicken scratch, yeah.
And so that was, I thought, pretty funny that they did that. And again, we've only seen the Binars, like, what, 3 times? Like, ever?
Yeah. I think my question was, though, so I watched it on my phone. I didn't have subtitles on, which I usually do. Did they do subtitles for the Binars? Do you know?
No, they didn't. They did not do it.
They didn't,
no.
Yeah, it was hard to follow, but you kind of get you got the gist because it was, like, the same setup as all the other ones, right?
Yep.
I'm going to proclaim a loose Easter egg here, or at least a callback of sorts, that Rutherford is trying to incorporate grapplers onto the shuttle.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was very Star Trek Enterprise NX-01. Like they had those on there because they didn't have the tractor beam. So kind of an interesting choice there in terms of like an analog thing for when like maybe the lights... beams of light don't work. I'll be curious to see if this was here is just like a you know, what sort of funny physical gag can we do with Tendi and Boimler, or if this is going to somehow pay off in the finale.
Hmm.
I thought it was interesting that especially we talked about last episode where there was this sort of will they won't they Rutherford and Tendi, you know, are they friends, are they more than friends kind of vibe, that the first scene back with the crew he fires the grappler and rips her shirt off.
Yeah, and even though like he shows no regard for Boimler's safety, and Boimler's like, are you sure we can just like put this on a crate or something, why do I have to hold this?
Yeah,
the fact that it as an experiment puts Tendi's life in danger really causes him to react.
Yeah.
Right? So I feel like they're still teasing us with that. Will they, won't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. It's ironic too, because the tractor beam was invented because they didn't have the budget to make a grappler, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also the idea of a grappler in space is a little weird.
But yeah.
Yeah. It did seem just a smidge hokey when they did it in Enterprise.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Some of the quotes, as always with Lower Decks, are priceless. when called a meat pipe, Boimler says, an ensign meat pipe. I want to meet with ensign meat pipe. And he says, joke's on him. I'm Lieutenant Junior Grade meat pipe now.
Yep.
have fun with the sinister robots who definitely aren't trying to trap you guys, from Mariner. Again, just obviously, the omniscient narrator there. From Agamus, I calculated the perfect ratio of sunlight and hydration. Apparently, life forms are just as easy to grow as they are to annihilate.
Yeah. With a sinister laugh. Yeah. With a
sinister laugh. Sinister laugh in some cases for like no clear reason whatsoever. Yeah. Just that's what he does.
Jeffrey Coombs is so good. So good as Agamus. And again, a Star Trek legend. Playing that role is so much fun. Unhand me, you greasy swine. Sack of chemicals. That's another one for you, Jaime. Sack of chemicals from Agamus. That was good. We talked about boop on the nose from Badgie repeatedly. That was funny. But it led to, he's bypassing our shields. We can't take many more boops from Shax. And sorry, Captain, but I just can't let Badgie boop my friends to death from Rutherford. Again, I love that they just dragged that gag out. That was so funny. Does co-conspirating mean nothing anymore, from Agamus? I like the sentiment. And Badgie, if you didn't just turn into an omniscient god, you have to tell us. From Mariner, yeah. Did you have any other ones, Jaime?
I had a couple quotes. So right up front, when the Drukumani discover, they scavenge Badgie, like, I'm Badgie, your helpful training program. Which of Starfleet's many secrets would you like to learn today?
Yeah.
It's like, why is the tech all with admin privileges fully on there? Like, you really need to have some security. And the tail end, when you have Gucci remaining, where he says, in this, like, intended to be this really nice and normal way, but it's sort of phrased sinisterly, like, do you want me to teach you a lesson? It's like, whoa, really? Like, is that any teachers out there? Is that what you tell your kids? I'm going to teach you a lesson today. Turn to page 35.
Yep. My big question for this one. So here we are at episode 7, 3 episodes to go, 8, 9, 10. We did get a little bit more on explaining what's actually happening. And I kind of wondered if this was the case. But it turns out that Agamus reveals to Boimler that the ships are not, in fact, being destroyed, that they're basically spreading debris and they are taking the ships, which is nice to know, too, because, again, we have seen, that's a lot of death for a show that is pretty lighthearted. So we had speculated that perhaps the Agamus, Peanut Hemper, Badgie, AI gone rogue triumvirate might have been one of the suspects. But now we're kind of getting down to brass tacks here. Any guesses on where this is headed?
We thought it was Badgie. We thought it was Badgie for a bit, right? So,
I mean, it would have made sense, right? AI, weird mystery ship, the whole thing. But now, of course, it's not just about like destruction. It's about taking. We've eliminated, obviously, some of the obvious suspects. It won't be, the Ferengi or, the Klingons or whatever. We've seen them being taken. Romulans, obviously. Now Binars. I wonder what we're up against here. I must admit, I haven't really put some hard thought into it. Again, I kind of thought the AI one was a reasonable hypothesis, but any thoughts?
No,
I'm tapped out on this because I thought it was going to end up being one of the AIs. And prematurely, I wrote in my notes that because it didn't turn out this way, I thought, our Badgie, Peanut Hamper and Agamus, the ultimate like evil villain trio, and it didn't work out that way.
No, no, they never crossed paths.
Hard to say.
Yeah.
All right. Well, three more. Let's find out.
So we have some keen facts to just sort of throw out there before they become next week's back check. Tendi didn't know about sand in season 1, episode 1.
Right.
The Binars first appeared in TNG season 1, episode 15. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Coombs returns as Agamus, which we already knew, but he also apparently originally auditioned for Riker.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
But he's been one of the most prolific. You didn't know that, or you did?
I did not know that he had applied for the job of Riker.
And in the original series, season one, episode five, The Enemy Within, Kirk splits into a good side and a bad side.
Yeah, that's a classic.
Yeah, and then,
that's one of the all-time hammiest early William Shatner performances.
Yeah, and it says the Tyrus VI-7A, the Tyrannus 7A research station was originally seen in TNG season 6, episode 9.
Yeah, I wrote that down, but I didn't have time to look it up, so good job on
him. And also the original Exocomps were there.
Yep. I love that Peanut Hamper's dad's name is Kevin, by the way. That would also kill me.
And then some of the... Why Kevin?
Just such a random thing for an exocomp to be named.
Yeah. Some of the badges... Some places badges took over. The satellite, it looks like the SS Birdseye from TNG Season 1, Episode 26. Starbase 25. Deep Space 9 or some other Cardassian-style spaceship.
Yep.
And Space Dock-style space station a la Star Trek Undiscovered Country. And Badgie says he might visit the Black Mountain, which was first mentioned in Season 2, Episode 3, the place where you go when you die, and he also saw a koala.
Man, Keen's killing it this week. Good job, mm-hmm. Keen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, this is our regular reminder. Come play in our sandbox. We'd love to see you on our channel, on our Slack channel. Come and interact with Keen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can challenge him to Wordle while you're at it.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's move on to Loki, Season 2, Episode 2, Breaking Brad, which is all about Breaking Brad.
Yep. I had to go with the setup that they threw at us, which was so the bad guy in this one was as Dox. So I said, a Dox on all your houses.
Yeah, that works really well, especially the houses piece, because the actress is... Lysa Arryn's actress from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my pitch would be, you do know I'm a god, right?
There you go. You all had more interesting ones. Mine was pretty straightforward of like, in order to find where Sylvie has gone, Loki and Mobius have to play good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, which leads right into the torture under the my pick for best pew 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 when Loki is working on X5 or Brad trying to get him to reveal the location of Sylvie and sort of what the big plan is and brings in this really I love the art design of this show. It's so weird and wonderful, but that's sort of neo-futuristic 1970s vibe. They brings in this like really ridiculous, like it looks like something from somewhere between like Solaris and Dr. Seuss device. I love it. I love the aesthetic. It's so weird.
It was almost like a line painter from a football field, you know?
Yeah. So random. But when he does the torture, of course, he starts opening a time door and then like squishing him inside the time door, more or less, right?
Yeah.
That was a good scene. And again, playing like Tom Hiddleston, just, you know, sneering and pretending to be the evil Loki as he goes through and tortures him was just, he's such a great actor. He's so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Any different pew 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 for you, Jaime?
I went with the more straightforward fight at the hangar, but I do appreciate the interrogation scene as a really good one too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sylvie and Loki just kind of join forces and take everybody all out at once, right?
Yeah, but not fast enough. Those guys. Jeez. That was grim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did struggle with that scene just a little bit. And it wasn't the action part of it. It was the sort of where they were cutting back and they're like, oh my God, they're destroying all the offshooted timelines. Oh my God. And they're like, billions of people are dying. I just feel like it wasn't as emotive as I was hoping for. Like, obviously, the idea that billions of people are dying and they're killing these timelines is very upsetting if you're a fan of the show and Marvel and everything else. But it's just, it's also kind of like, there was no like cut to dimension where like people are disappearing in a flash and people are holding their children. Like, it just sort of was happening on a screen and we're seeing the emotions of the characters of the TVA, but it didn't hit as hard as I think I would have liked it to.
Yeah, I agree. There's no buy-in from us.
Yeah, it just felt like, you know, when you see them disappear on a screen, you're supposed to be like, each one of those was as rich a timeline as the one we currently live in. And so therefore, all those lives are extinguished. And of course, when you philosophically think about it, it's sad and tragic and upsetting. But when you're not actually experiencing the emotional connection to that, it's just a thing that happened on a screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the maybe best example, because I also agree that that didn't quite hit the way they maybe wanted it to, that, you know, the most effective balance of this is the dream sequence, Sarah Connor's dream sequence from Terminator 2, where you should be way more horrified that, like, you know, 100,000 to a million people die in the instant flash of the nuclear bomb going off. But you can't really, like, grok that, right? Like, thousands of people is just like a statistic, but one person is a tragedy. So when you see the kids in the playground getting taken out, it feels more immediate than when you see Sarah Connor, a main character, get taken out, and you really feel it. And I feel like that's a really nice concrete way to show that. So I think, to your point, that like there are examples from other media where they could have made the decision to do something like that as well.
Yeah, for sure. For my Easter egg, I know this is one of those shows you need to watch like 10 times and you need to slow it down, because there were so many like posters and signs and stuff, especially that started at the beginning in London. I know there was a ton of stuff there, but I was just watching it through because I kind of didn't have a ton of time. I know there's stuff there. I'm sure that by the time you read some of the Easter egg articles online over the next little bit, there'll be a lot. The only thing I really caught was that bit at the end with Sylvie, when she's sitting on her truck and she pulls something out. What she pulls out is the device that He Who Remains was wearing last season in the finale. That I recognized. Mm-hmm. So she clearly, she's not like isolated in this little universe, this little pocket that she's found for herself with the job at McDonald's and everything else. She can clearly still, whether it's a device for traveling through the different timelines or whether it's a, you know, she can see through the, like, whatever it is, she's clearly got still some abilities that she can tap into. Did you guys catch anything else?
I really didn't. The only lame Easter egg here I'm going to say here is the title is similar to Breaking Bad.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. That was so funny though. It's a good play.
I checked the box here, but I didn't do anything super great in terms of finding Easter egg.
Yeah. Quotes wise, I like Brad's line, stop trying to be a hero. You're a villain, man, and you're good at it. Do that. I thought that was good. And of course, it comes back and bites Brad in the butt later on. When OB comes upstairs and says, we're all going to die. Oh, it's nice to meet you. Again, Kehi Kwan is just, he's so good at those little like quirky deliveries that was very funny. And Mobius, again, just such a weird quirky character too. I'm not going anywhere until I've had to get some apple pie. Mm-hmm. Like, yep, got your priorities straight. It's good.
And he ends up with key lime pie instead.
Well, he gets key lime pie the first time, and then the second time he wants the vintage 1970s molten lava McDonald's apple pie, right? Remember those things?
Yes.
Hi, Mary, are you old enough to remember the molten lava versions of the deep fried apple pies?
Yeah, I don't understand what actually happened here. So just as a little, because you brought it up and I'm in a nostalgic mood. So I don't know if it was a cost saving thing. I don't know if it was given the molten lava description, which is quite accurate. I don't know if it was a let's not get sued thing. But I used to enjoy not so much the apple, not as much an apple, more the cherry pies.
Oh, yes.
They're also very similarly were like, you know, like a hot pocket, you know, full. Mm-hmm. Of molten lava.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? And the exterior wasn't this like, you know, sort of bake, it's soft and cuddly. No, this
was like an egg roll.
Like you, yeah, it's fried and bubbly and it looks like If you remember from the Watchmen movie, the 2009 movie, when Rorschach throws the hot oil on that dude's face, like that's exactly what it did to that dude's face is exactly what it did to the wonderful dough of that era's pies,
and in turn to your tongue when you bit into it.
I'm sure it was the number of lawsuits they got from those is why they got rid of that.
I mean,
that particular dessert.
I must admit, I it's been a long time. So, you know, obviously apple pie. I have not had like a deep fried, you know, apple turnover kind of thing like they used to make. I'm really curious if there's places out there that still make that style somewhere. There must be some nostalgic baker who's making like the molten lava versions of those things.
Yeah, probably not serving them quite as hot, though.
Oh, I hope not, because, man, I still have, like, cringe visions when I think about biting into those things. They were so tasty, but, oh, man, if you bit before they cooled down enough, you were paying a price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely have to gingerly take that first, you know, teeth-only bite, right?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, again, I was, like, a pretty small kid when they still had those on sale, and, oof, yeah. Like, I want my apple pie!
Yeah. All right.
Big question for this one. I love this show and I enjoy it, and I'm not trying to knock it down, but do you think this show has gotten a little too complex?
No, I like it. I like the vibe of this show.
I found the sort of multiple storylines where it's sort of, you know, Ouroboros, and again he's talking about, you know, the trying to sort of stop this time catastrophe, while simultaneously we've got Docs somewhere doing something that else is going to affect the timeline, while somewhere else we've got Sylvie doing something else is going to affect the timeline. I just feel like it was, and then of course the main plot, which was the Brad, you know, had gone to the main timeline and was messing around with it there. I just found it, I was like, And again, I was able to follow it. I'm sure a lot of people are able to follow it. I just wonder, for the audience that Disney needs for this, which is a pretty mainstream one. The first season was very successful. Loki's a very popular character. I was thinking, like, is this starting to get a little too timey-wimey, you know, convoluted? Or is this
the docs, and I don't know what those guards are called, but that
the Minutemen.
Yeah, you're right. The Minutemen. That's a bit. Yeah, true. That's funny. Funny name. Now you say that. They're quite strange, and I do miss Miss Manners too, right?
Miss Minutes, yeah.
Miss Minutes, she was a good character, but I'm sure they keep dropping the name, so she's probably coming back at some point.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it is that part. You're right. I kind of gloss over that part when I see it, right? So
yeah,
look, I'm more interested in the dynamic between Loki and Mobius.
Yeah, the Loki Mobius and the Loki Sylvie of it all are the most important parts. That's why I think the first episode worked really well, because there was so much of the Loki Mobius. This one, the whole good cop definitely played off the strength of that, and then started to reestablish Sylvie. So again, I think there's some very strong through lines through here. It's the timey-wimey-ness of it all. I thought, you know, is everyone able to follow along with like all these different sort of competing time catastrophe storylines, but hopefully it's just my overthinking it and not the reality, because I hope that this is something people are enjoying.
I am, that's all that matters.
Well, true, yeah. If we can get Tim invested, then we know we've won.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I will move on to our watch list then, I guess, right?
Yep.
All right, so I'm up first. I forgot to mention last week that I did go see The Creator on the day it came out. I happened to have, you know, a few hours to kill on a Friday afternoon. So I went to like a 1 o'clock matinee or whatever, and I saw it in IMAX. And it was really good in IMAX. It's an interesting, going into it, I think I mentioned that it did seem a bit derivative, and it totally is. It's a mashup of like just about every really decent sci-fi movie out there that you've seen, like plot line, like there's a lot of different plot lines that cross over from other shows that you've seen, but it is very interesting to look at. And I saw an interview with the director, the guy who did Rogue One, as a matter of fact. He approached this a little differently in that he went on location and shot the scenes on location, and then they superimposed the tech in, right? So rather than everybody running around with, you know, green screen or, you know, looking at tennis balls and stuff like that, he had them actually in the spaces. And he was able to incorporate the, because it takes place in Thailand and, you know, places like that where it's all lush and green and things. And so they, the technology kind of like work in real environments, which was really kind of neat to see that. So it was a really interesting story, interesting plot line, good performances, blows up real good, like I said here. Surprisingly or not surprisingly, it was beat out in the box office on the first 2 weeks of that it was out. I mean, it was beat by Paw Patrol, the Mighty Movie.
Oof.
That was that the first Paw Patrol movie?
No, that is the sequel. It's very confusing brand naming scheme, but
yeah.
As somebody who has seen the first one of those movies, and I think I said, wow, it's like surprisingly good for this obvious, yeah, you know, kids commercial for toys kind of thing. The Rotten Tomatoes, because I did check here, it's like 80 and 90 some percent for both of those movies. So it wasn't just the juggernaut of commercialism and like, we got to put these kids out there somewhere where they're quiet. Apparently it's another one that they've knocked out of the park for the kind of category they're going for.
Yeah. And so Creator also came out against Saw X, or is it Saw 10? Has there been 10 of those movies so far? And then Talk to Me, which are, the beginning of the Halloween horror season, right? So, or Halloween horrible season, as Jonathan would call it.
Yeah.
So the creator was good. I'm glad I saw it. It's interesting the way it's told, though, because it's told like a book, right? In that, I think there's like, there might have been three or four acts, maybe three acts, I guess, would make more sense. But at the beginning of an act, they would have like a big chapter screen, which is just black screen with, you know, Chinese and English text saying the mother or the child or the, you know, the hero, kind of like introducing that section of the movie, right? So it was kind of interesting way that they broke up the movie that way, right? So yeah, it's pretty interesting story. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, it's like the AI is the villain in this, but it turns out that the AI is not really the villain. The humans that are villain, of course, right? It's definitely pretty movie. Definitely, if you get a chance to watch it, I'd say just go in and watch it. It was really good.
I do wonder if the marketing, I'd be curious to know what the marketing budget was. Is the marketing feel was, I feel like appropriate for the movie, like the kind of marketing that I saw. I'm getting at the locations for like this kind of movie. It normally shows up, at least for me, anecdotally, in like normal people channels, you know. I'd see it on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and I'd see it on like, you know, normal people television. I feel like the only time I saw ads, and I did see probably several ads, the only ads I saw were on YouTube, which is certainly fine. That's probably an audience, but that doesn't seem like a recipe for, you know, here's this, this spent a lot of money sci-fi type flick.
Yeah.
It feels more like, oh, here's an indie movie, you know, came out of Sundance. Kind of thing.
So ironically, it was before all the big movies of the summer. Like I saw it before Mission Impossible, I saw it before the Indiana Jones, I saw it before I think Oppenheimer, I saw it before that. So it was before all this, but like that's the wrong place to do it because we're not back in the theaters yet, right? That's where those, you know, like that was one of the, definitely one of, you'd see that trailer every time you went out. I don't know if Jonathan, if you've managed to see the trailer when you were at one of the movies recently, right?
Yeah, no.
It wasn't. Yeah, definitely, because it was kind of, yeah, it was a really interesting trailer. I mean, I did had a link in the show notes 2 weeks ago, but I'll have a link again. But the trailer's good too, and the trailer doesn't give away a lot of the sort of nuance of the story, but just, I think bad marketing, like you said, Jaime. I think especially, like, you know, I'm a paid YouTube subscriber, so I would not have seen those on YouTube. I had to, you know, the only place I ever saw it, I think I might have seen one on television, but yeah, it's mostly been in the theater, and I go to movies, right? So I'm like in the minority. All right. So my second one is just to sort of recap on what we were talking about before. I did finish Justified yesterday. I got all the way through the last one. I found the short series I just did, I think 8 episodes. It was good, but it wasn't as engaging as, I mean, I really like the character, but it wasn't as engaging as the sort of the series, right? The 6 seasons.
I think the moral of that one is the villain was the star of the first series.
Yeah. Well, and spoilers, but yeah, because you're wondering where he is in this whole thing, and you do get a little sneak peek into his, He's sort of in the trailer right at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Which lets you know that this series could come back again, which mm-hmm. which is good, because I mean it's a really interesting character, but yeah, and he doesn't do a lot of Marshall-y kind of stuff until the very last, you know, the conclusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, really interesting character. I think Jonathan and I were talking about it maybe on this show, but I can't remember, but it's kind of like the Kentucky version of Breaking Bad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in terms of how intense it is and how, like, what is going on here and, you know, the twists and turns.
Yeah, and there's a few moments where you're like, you think you got it figured out and they'll throw you just an absolute left turn where you're like, oh, that character just died. That person was actually evil. Like, there's a few of them where you're like, whoa, wow.
So the big questions that I came out of this, and I talked to Jonathan about this in a text message the other day, was I worked in bars, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the night, when you work in a bar, you lock the door, right? I can't tell you the number of plot lines that, like, I gotta say, like, it must have been, I would say, close to 10 times somebody would come into the bar, whatever bar it was, after it was closed, and the characters would turn around and say, we're closed.
Yeah.
And of course, then they would pull out their guns and, you know, madness would ensue. But lock the door. Well, I guess maybe in those environments, you don't lock your doors. I don't know. Like, crazy. There was a bunch of like, what, man, like really seriously kind of things in there. Yeah. So, yeah. Good series.
Good. Glad you liked it.
Mm-hmm. Tommy, you're up.
Yeah, so the first two episodes of the Frasier continuation have dropped on Paramount+.
Oh, it's in Seattle, right?
Well, technically, no. And they actually play with that a little bit in the, you know, the interstitial and title cards. So
yeah,
it starts with the, you know, the Space Needle skyline kind of thing and gets wiped. And then eventually when you get to the main part, it's like, oh, I assume this is the Boston skyline.
Oh.
It's not as recognizable. No, I have to take a picture and without the Frasier logo on it, send it to Dr. Mark Rubin here and be like, hey, which city is this? And see if he himself can even recognize it. But this series does take place in Boston. So we do learn that Martin Crane has recently passed away. So they give a little, you know, nod of the cap to him. Frasier has apparently been the past 20 some years living in Chicago with his TV show. And now in sort of the premise for the first two episodes that they set up here is him trying to reconnect with his son, Frederick, who's, you know, a young man, I guess. I forget the age. I didn't do the math, but he's like a grown adult.
Who'd been born in the 80s, right? So.
Yeah, he's like a grown adult here, and you know, you've got a new cast of characters, like the son's roommate, some former colleagues of Frasier's from when he was there at Harvard, the Harvard president, and the son, the college age son who's going to Harvard, of his brother Niles Crane and Daphne Moon Crane. So. My take, and again, it's only the first two episodes, and I feel like that was a really specific choice they had here of, like, the first episode kind of has to do a lot of, like, what the heck happened in the last 20-some odd years, right? So it's got to sort of deal with that sort of shift in the time jump, and it's no longer in Seattle, we're not going to have all the same characters. I feel like a little bit, if you look back at the original episodes of Frasier, the sort of like jump for, you know, moving from Cheers to in Boston to Seattle, right, back home. So like there's a little bit of the setup. I'm like, okay, I'll give it a pass for this one. The second episode felt like they were starting to get into more of a groove. Mm-hmm. Not 100% sold on some of the characters and some of the actor portrayals, but I feel like by the second episode, I'm like, oh yeah, this is definitely Frasier Crane, right? Like in a new environment, sure, but I didn't really, like, I was alive during the transition, but I, as a wee lad, was not watching a whole bunch of Cheers. I wasn't quite old enough to, like, really get the gist at that point. So I didn't feel the transition of, like, whoa, hashtag not my Frasier Crane, or whatever the equivalent would have been when Frasier first came out from the spinoff of Cheers, right? So I'm going to give us a little bit of a chance here. I do enjoy Kelsey Grammer's portrayal, and I do feel like he really starts to get into it by that second episode. So pretty sure that's why they dropped the first two, because if it was just the first one, probably would feel a lot different for that.
So he ran off to Chicago at the end of the original series to be with the Laura Linney character, right?
Yeah, and
do they explain what has happened there? Is it
there's a throwaway gag about I can't even remember. I should have written that down as a quote, but essentially, like, I think she dumped him at some point, and so that's where he's just a freely swinging bachelor now.
This is where the whole sort of reboot culture on some of these shows, like, it's inescapable. Obviously, you know, some characters, the actors have actually died. Some circumstances, it's that they don't want to come back and revisit these roles. But it's the undoing of seemingly happy endings. Of course, there's no such thing as a true happy ending, but, you know, for fiction, that's a satisfying thing when you're like, you know, he gives up his radio show and he moves to Chicago because he loves this woman. And then you're like, yeah, but that didn't work out. Like, oh, man, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that they can do here, I think, is kind of like the way that the Cheers characters would make appearances every once in a while in the Frasier show. I think they'll probably end up doing the same. I think you had mentioned that we're probably not going to see David Hyde Pierce because he'd given up the Niles character. But no reason we couldn't see Daphne, who seems to be canonically still alive.
Roz, for sure.
Roz, Bulldog gets called out. So nice. Canonically still alive. Nice. So I feel like they could still do some stuff. And I am wondering if they're going to do some sort of joke with the Eddie character, which obviously cannot reasonably be alive, but it's a good sight gag, right? Of like seeing a dog that's the same Jack Russell Terrier style and just having him freak out. And the other character would be like, yo, what's up? Why are you so obsessed with this dog? He's like, no, it was a thing. I left it in the past.
That's, yeah, you're right. They could easily do something like that.
Cool. Do you have any thing, John?
No, I got to admit, it was a bit of a crazy busy week, and I was lucky to watch the two shows I did.
All right, cool. Well, I guess that's it for another week. Then, Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
If you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at JPK News, or you can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/@JPK.
And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevWithTheHair.
All right, my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machines, where you'll find me. Until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 Yep. And bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
So Strike Force 5 is over. They had their last show yesterday.
Yeah, I haven't listened to the very last one, but I listened to the second one with the wives, second one that they did earlier in the week. And yeah, it's bittersweet. I really thought they were finding their groove, but obviously unsustainable. But yeah, the running gags about them like trying to sell merch now are very funny.
Yeah. Well, apparently they sold quite a... Three printings of the t-shirt, right?
Really? So, good.
Yeah, so they actually did, better, little spoilers for the episode, but they actually did a lot better than they were kidding about. So
good. Well, and, I mean, it's a nice idea. Like, it's really nice that these people use their fame for for positivity and not just for greed.
Yeah, and the Ryan Reynolds ads goes to a whole another level.
Oh, nice. I'll
spoil it for you.
Yeah. All right. I'll definitely make a point to this weekend. I'm still hanging out of this cold. Having to travel on top of still being a little bit under the weather and then all that, I just haven't been able to shake this off. I haven't had a good night's sleep in, I don't know, what year is it? So, yeah, I need to spend the weekend trying to sort of chill out a little bit. Although my wife is now also sick and we've got tickets to a show tomorrow, so we'll see.
What's the show?
It's the album launch party for the new Metric album.
Oh, Metric.
So you might get a call tomorrow. Just, you know, put that out there. Hey, want to go see Metric? Sure, you're sick.
For me?
Yeah, it's actually, you know where the show is? It's at the old Masonic Temple.
It's up on the corner.
Yeah. The one up in Rosedale there, yeah.
Never actually been in that building. I've been by it because I had a customer who worked right next door to it.
Yeah, I used to go and see shows there, and then they closed. They made it into a TV studio theater, at one point for a while. And now
MTV, right?
Yeah,
MTV
something. And then they've changed it so that now it's back to being just a concert venue. They've renamed it the Concert Hall, although it still says Masonic Temple outside. But
yeah.
But it still looks like the same sort of old venue. If you go through, this is a good exercise for you, Tim. If you go onto the Wikipedia entry for the concert hall, it talks about all the historic shows that have been held there over the years. Uh-huh. Holy mother of pearl. You should see the people that have played in this place. Like, you know, it's not a big venue. I think it's 1200 is the capacity. Like Led Zeppelin, Frank Zappa. Like,
wow. Yeah.
It's like A-list bands that came through and played there on their Toronto stops over the years. Like, you know, all the new wave stuff that I like the first Toronto Cure show was there. The first Depeche Mode show was there. Like it's a crazy list from the 60s onward. Buddy Guy. And like, yeah, it's bonkers. How many great artists have played there.
Yeah. Apparently there's a lot of places called Masonic Temple.
Yeah, it's the one right across from the Canadian Tire, like Young and Davisville, right?
Totally familiar with it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I had a customer offices right next door.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a beautiful building. If you can look up the pictures online of the inside, it looks very like old school.
Yeah.
But yeah. So hopefully the missus will feel well enough tomorrow too.
Yeah. What's his name used to film there? Mike Bullard?
Yeah, I think they made it into like a CTV studio at one point. So they weren't doing concerts.
Muddy Waters
they
were, played there.
They were doing that instead. So
it used to be called the Rock Pile at one point. Muddy Waters played there. Albert King, Buddy Guy.
Yeah. No, I'm telling you.
Jethro Tull, John Lee Hooker, and Muddy Waters.
Yeah, some of the double bills are insane too, where you're like,
Deep Purple.
This Lighthouse. Person opened for that person. You're like, my God, even just to see one.
The Who, Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
This is going back to like 1969.
Yeah.
Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
They're still playing there. Alice Cooper, The Animals. Wow. Keith Jarrett, Gang of Four.
And when you look at the venue too, like it's to say the least intimate. It's a small concert hall. Mm-hmm. Like you'd have been on top of them, like to see the people Jam, of that stature.
The Stranglers. Yeah. Iggy Pop.
Yep.
Iron Maiden.
One of them was something for it was like a punk show, and it was like the Ramones and somebody else that just like blew me away. It was like a double bill, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, the English Beat played there. That would have been cool to see.
The beat in like 1980 would be amazing.
Teenage Head, Nash the Slash.
Yeah.
Depeche Mode.
Yep.
Wow.
But it's Depeche Mode in like 81, right? Like
82, yeah.
Yeah, like Babies.
Yeah. Dead Kennedys.
Yeah.
Iggy Pop again.
Yeah.
Flock of Seagulls. Public Image. That's
Yep.
Johnny Lydon.
Yep.
English Beat again. The Bangles opened for them.
Yeah.
Boons. Wranglers again. Motorhead. Nina Hagen.
Nina Hagen. There you go.
Nina Hagen again. Queensryche and Twisted Sister. Echo and the Bunnymen. R.E.M.
Yep.
NXS.
Yep.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood. The Cure, like you said.
Yeah.
Parachute Club, of course. Los Lobos and Blue Rodeo.
Yeah.
That's a weird bill.
That's a weird bill, isn't it?
Yeah. Weird Al.
Weird Al in like 85, right?
Yeah. Merillion. Replacement. Violent Femmes.
Yep.
That would have been good.
Yep. I saw the Femmes. Wow. First show I ever saw was the Femmes in 87.
You know, Hagen again. Public Enemy. That's a different public. 5440. I know that family. I know that the singer dude.
Well, tell him if he wants lots of pictures of himself. I shot them like 5 times back in the 90s.
Are you really? Because I'm friends with his daughter, so I'll let him know.
Yeah. Oh, I've got tons of pictures of the band from back in the day.
Really? Okay, cool. I'll pass on that message. Tragically Hip.
Yep.
Including a concert poster. Wow. I'm just at the 90s now. Skinny Puppy, Ice Cube, Jane's Addiction, Pixies. Men Without
to Pat. See most of these bands in a venue that small, like, damn, yeah. That would have been amazing.
Three nights of the Hip.
Yeah.
That's when it was called the Concert Hall. Pearl Jam. Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
5440 again. Alice in Chains.
Yep.
Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
That would have been good.
Yep. I missed them on that one, but I saw them the next time they came to town.
Green Day. Oh, they were there twice, the Rage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Beck. Weird Al again. Teenage Head again. That would have been in 96. That would have been a sad show.
Mm.
James Brown. That James Brown?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Like James Brown again in 87. Crazy.
Yeah. As I say, I knew that it was a popular venue before they turned it into that movie studio, but I did not realize quite the history until I looked it up because I was trying to find pictures to show my wife. And I was just like, huh. Yeah, look at this. Yeah. Oh my God, look at this. Oh my God, look at this.
Well, they filmed a spectacle with Elvis Costello. Spectacle was filmed there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He interviewed like U2 in this particular case. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it was CTV, I mean, that's kind of like, that's just like a TV show, right?
Mm hmm. Mm-hmm.
They would have had stars on.
Yep.
Oh, so a 54th anniversary of Led Zeppelin show. Zed? Mm-hmm. Who's Zed? Cover band, I guess.
Is it ZEDD?
ZEDD, yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Never heard of them. Hmm. Like, I guess they're like a tribute band.
Yeah. No.
A tribute to the music of Led Zeppelin.
There's money to be made, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not so sure it'd be that amazing to cover that band. Yeah. But mind you, have you seen Mr. Jimmy?
No.
Mr. Jimmy is, he tours with Jason Bonham right now. And he came out of Japan and he looks like Jimmy Page.
Hmm.
And he plays like Jimmy Page.
Whoa.
Yeah, and if you go online, there's a video of him playing in a small restaurant in Japan or China or wherever he's from, right?
Yep.
And in the audience is Jimmy Page.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and you know, comes over and meets him at the end of it, and he's like, totally, you know, amazing work you did, good job, and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, but now he's touring with a member of like the gene pool
of
Led Zeppelin, covering Led Zeppelin, right?
That's funny.
If you go on the YouTube, you'll see him playing there, so... And he looks like that in 1970s Jimmy Page.
Yeah. One of the other shows that I saw listed on that list was like a 1982 or 83 Stevie Ray Vaughan show. Uh-huh. That would have been amazing. I'm still haunts me that I never got to see Stevie Ray play live.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, famously his Toronto show that they recorded was the Elmo, right? That was on TV.
Yeah. 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 No, I knew of him at the time, but same thing. I never went, Yeah. Oh, yeah. Open mic with Mike Bullard was in 99, it looked like.
Mm.
But if you, he had like, you know, Black Crows, you know,
yep.
Gentle Krabby Ed Jack,
yep.
Blue Rodeo, Django Jones, Sweet Horror Down, Spoons.
Good. As a strange coincidence, so Mike must live somewhere not far from here. Back in the era of 24-hour grocery stores, I used to come back from working either, you know, any of the papers that I worked at. And I would be doing my like late night grocery shopping, and I would see Mike on his way also doing his late night grocery mm-hmm. shopping. I saw him mm-hmm. on multiple occasions. And it's like, hey, dude, how's it going? He's like, oh, yeah, good, good. Like, you know,
yeah,
he was one of those type of people who's just sort of in the community, you know, like you see Johnny Bauer around all the time before he passed. Johnny used to live around here.
Did he? Yeah.
Yeah. I used to see him at Walmart all the time. And he would, one, he's recognizable face, but two, he would be wearing his Leafs like bomber jacket.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody knew who he was, and everybody be like, you know, good to see you, Mr. Bauer. You know, thanks for everything, Mr. Bauer. Like, he was just, everybody loved him. He was such a nice guy.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen him before, like, seen him live, like, at awards or, like, you know, puck dropping and stuff like that. But I'm not sure you've seen him in, like, closer than center ice.
The one that blew me away was I'd had a chance to meet Pinball Clemens professionally before. And then I went to Argo training camp and they had like the media day where we got to like play and stuff. So I you know, like I knew Mike like okay, but not like well. But one day I was like at like Costco or something and I walked in and of course, he's a very distinctive looking person, Mike Clemens. And saw him and I was like, hey, Pinball. And he was like, hey, I know you, man. I was like, oh, my God, I cannot believe you remember me. But he was like, oh, yeah, man, I remember you. You played in that game and blah, blah. I was like, oh, my God, like, that's a good memory. Wow. I've only is the only person that I've ever, as a member of the media, asked for a picture with was at that media event. I had somebody take a picture of me and Pinball. It's the only time I've ever done that with any famous person ever, because he was just the nicest dude.
Yeah. I have a picture of Rick Talkett from a, but I have no, I mean, I wasn't a huge Leaf fan at the time, but
yeah,
he was a, like, he was the star at a golf tournament I went to.
And oh, so, nice. Yeah,
I had to take a picture with Rick Talkett.
Yeah. The one was one night we got out of the Star, and of course the Star building is just down the street from where the Leafs play. And we were in the bar. We went to the bar as we typically did at the end of the night. And we were sitting there, and there's a couple guys sitting at the bar, and one of my buddies goes, that's Craig McTavish. And he was doing TV at the time. He says, that's Craig McTavish. I said, yeah. He's like, oh man, I was a huge fan of his when he used to play for the Flyers. And Jaime, for your edification, this is the last player to play without a helmet. He played into his like late 30s, and he was the last grandfathered person in, so that he didn't have to wear a helmet if he didn't want to. So he never wore a helmet. And my buddy was just like, I gotta go say something to him. Like, come with me. And I was like, okay, fine. So he walked over. He's like, oh, Mr. McTavish, I'm sorry to bother you. Really want to, and like the super nice guy to him, and like posed for a picture with him and stuff like that. And just made my buddy's day that like got a picture taken with Craig McTavish. Yep. Like, all right, aim small. I could tell he was like, do you want your picture taken? I'm like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, really? Yeah. It's funny, speaking of hockey, like Carol used to do the ads for the hockey news, the actual paper that, you know, even the players read. And she went down to Buffalo to the Buffalo auditorium or whatever. And she was standing there like standing in the thing. And there was some, you know, famous hockey player standing beside her. And she never stopped to say, hey, can you write your name on a piece of paper? Or, you know, just completely ignored him because she's just not into hockey. Turned out to be Wayne Gretzky.
Oops. She told us that story when she came home, and both of us were like, are you kidding us?
She's like, yeah, he was there.
Yeah.
No big deal. Yeah. I got to watch him play. Yeah. Or, like, got to watch him practice on the ice.
Yeah.
You know?
That was one of my very happiest hockey/journalism memories, was that I Wayne Gretzky played long enough that I got to cover him as a professional and meet him and do a press conference and talk to Walter and take pictures and that at Maple Leaf Gardens, no less, which of course was it's no longer now a Loblaws, but that definitely is still high up on my lifetime achievement list. My very own pictures of the great one.
Well, I got to get back to my project, and I'm supposed to be 3 days behind on deadline. So,
all right, well, off you go.
Yep. Friday the 20th.
Okie doke. All right.
All right.
I'll talk to you later.
Have a good one, guys.
Bye.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.